Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins, Pete Musto, and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, countries around the world are spending as much money on their militaries today as they did 30 years ago. Researchers say military spending worldwide in 2018 was fueled by increased spending in the United States and China, the world's two largest economies. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute reported Monday that governments spent $1.82 trillion on troops and military equipment in 2018. That represents an increase of 2.6% on the total a year earlier. CIPRI said the amount spent last year represents the most military spending since 1988. That was the year when spending information first became available as Cold War tensions began to ease. The Cold War lasted over 30 years. On one side was the Soviet Union and its allies, largely in Eastern Europe. On the other was the United States and its allies, mostly in Western countries. Last year, U.S. military spending rose 4.6% to reach $649 billion. The United States spent more than any other country on troops and military equipment. It was responsible for nearly 36% of total military spending worldwide. CIPRI noted that that amount is nearly equal to the combined spending of the next eight countries on the list. China was the second biggest spender. It spent $250 billion in 2018, an increase of 5% compared to the year before. China has increased defense spending every year for the past 24 years. Nan Tian works as a researcher with the CIPRI Arms and Military Expenditure Program. He said, in 2018, the USA and China accounted for half of the world's military spending. CIPRI said last year marked the first increase in U.S. military spending since 2010. The group added that President Donald Trump's defense spending request to Congress this year is the largest ever before adjusting for inflation. Trump has expressed support for strong national defenses, but promised to remove U.S. troops from conflict areas around the world. After the United States and China, the other top spenders are Saudi Arabia, India, France, Russia, Britain, Germany, Japan, and South Korea.
Anecdotal reports suggest that both the United States and China are increasing restrictions on travel by educators between the countries. Some experts worry about the effect those actions could have on understanding between the world's two largest economies. In recent weeks, news media have reported on how some professors and researchers learned they would no longer be able to travel freely between the two countries. These academics have been making such trips for many years, but are no longer permitted to do so. One Chinese scholar was stopped by U.S. federal agents at Los Angeles International Airport in January as he prepared to return to Beijing. The New York Times reported that the agents took his passport. Then, the officials canceled the 10-year visa that he had used to travel freely between the countries. Michael Pillsbury works for the Hudson Institute and has advised the Trump administration on China policy. He completed a visa request so he could attend a conference in Beijing. Last week, he told the Axios website that the Chinese embassy in Washington delayed action on his visa for so long that he was unable to attend. There are no available records that show exactly how many Chinese and U.S. academics have been denied visas in the recent past. But people who study relations between the countries claim the rate of denials has risen sharply. David Shamba is director of the China Policy Program at George Washington University. He wrote in the South China Morning Post that limiting academic exchanges can only hurt both countries. This kind of tit-for-tat action is a race to the bottom, only hurts both sides and adds to mutual suspicions, he said. Both governments should depoliticize scholarly visas and allow unfettered academic exchanges between the two countries so as to contribute to scholarly research and enhance mutual understanding. Visa denials are not a new thing for either country, but in the past, most of the denials have been one way. China has long barred scholars from visiting the country when they have written books critical of the Chinese Communist Party. This time, however, the push for more visa denials appears to be coming from the U.S. government. U.S. officials worry about the Chinese government's power to force non-government officials into gathering information for its own state intelligence services. Other U.S. officials have raised similar national security concerns about the use of telecommunications equipment made by Chinese companies. Chinese law requires companies operating in China to help when government intelligence services ask them to do so. That leads U.S. officials to be concerned that Chinese equipment could be made to create hidden ways to control computers in the United States. If those computers were at power or water treatment stations, the results could be disastrous. There have already been cases of industrial spying and intellectual property theft by Chinese companies. There appears to be concern among U.S. officials that the attacks could expand into other areas. I'm Jill Robbins.
Lisa Love of Twin Falls in the western American state of Idaho has not seen her doctor of 25 years since she started using a healthcare service called telemedicine. With telemedicine, a person can contact a doctor from wherever they are using a smartphone or other device and discuss their health concerns in a video conference. Love no longer waits for the doctor's office to open. She does not even have to leave her home. She used virtual visits last summer for help with a skin problem and returned for another small issue. She told the Associated Press she does not feel the need to seek care in the traditional way, especially since she also gets free health exams at work. Last year, the Kaiser Family Foundation, a healthcare research group, found that about 25% of adults in the United States do not have one doctor they visit often. That jumps to 45% for those under age 30. Some people, like Love, wonder how much they still need a regular doctor. Telemedicine probably can't do everything, but for most of the things I might ever have, I'm pretty sure they can take care of it, she said. Other people have moved to walk-in clinics and urgent care centers. And more medical services are using teams of professionals to keep patients healthy. They limit visits with a doctor to just the more serious cases.
Healthcare experts say the changing, disconnected nature of care is exactly why people still need someone who looks out for their overall health. That has been the traditional responsibility of family doctors. They know patients' medical histories, and they are trained to identify problems instead of just dealing with the symptoms that led to the patient's visit. They also can make sure different medicines work together, as well as help make sense of information patients find with an internet search. Sam Glick is an executive with the research firm Oliver Wyman. He said the idea of a family doctor as the single best solution for everyone is changing a great deal. This change began years ago when drugstores started providing anti-flu injections and opening clinics that handle minor issues like ear infections. The two largest drugstore companies in the U.S., CVS Health and Walgreens, now run about 1,500 clinics combined. More recently, employers have started adding workplace clinics. And thousands of urgent care centers have opened around the country to treat emergencies that are not life-threatening. Then there is telemedicine.
Love said she loves the virtual visits. They only cost $42, or less than half the price of an office visit under her insurance plan. I like technology, and I like new things, and I like saving money, Love said. It was worth it to me to try it. On top of all the competition for patients, the field also is fighting a shortage of doctors as medical school students aim for higher-paying specialties. Healthcare services have changed by adding physician assistants or nurse practitioners to cover yearly physical examinations and other minor care. They are also creating teams that help them take a wider look at patient health. Those teams might include mental health specialists who look for depression and health instructors who can improve diet and exercise.
The idea is to keep patients healthy instead of waiting to treat them after they become sick. We want to do as much outside the walls of the clinic as we can, said Megan Mahoney,
a doctor with Stanford University in California. She noted that this push depends on insurers expanding what they will cover. Doctors say the team-based services are changing their relationships with patients. Harvard Medical School professor Russell Phillips, also a doctor, often answers emails or questions from his patients. He also connects them with clinics for minor issues like urinary tract infections. Phillips says healthcare is changing into more of a flowing virtual relationship where patients have shorter visits with their doctors more often. Traditionally, patients would usually only visit their family doctor maybe 2 times a year. Getting medical care is such a complex activity that people really need somebody who can advise, guide, and coordinate for them, Phillips said. People still really want a relationship with someone who can do that. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Steve Ember and Shirley Griffith talk about Calvin Coolidge and how he became President of the United States.
The early 1920s were a troubled time for the United States. Congress and the public began to discover crimes by several officials in the administration of President Warren Harding. Harding himself became seriously sick during a trip to Alaska and western states. He died in a hotel room in California in August 1923. Harding's vice president, Calvin Coolidge, became the new president. Both men were Republicans. Their policies on issues were much the same. Coolidge, however, was a very different man. He was completely honest. He was the kind of president the country needed to rebuild public trust in the government.
Calvin Coolidge was quiet and plain-looking. He was the son of a farmer and political leader from the small northeastern state of Vermont. Young Calvin worked at different jobs to pay for his college education. He became a lawyer. He moved to another northeastern state, Massachusetts, where he became active in Republican Party politics. First, he was elected mayor of the town. Then he was elected to the state legislature. Finally, he was elected governor of Massachusetts. It was as governor that Coolidge first became known throughout the United States.
In 1919, a group of policemen in the city of Boston tried to start a labor union. This violated the rules of the police department. So the commissioner of police suspended 19 of the union's leaders. The next day, almost 75% of Boston's policemen went on strike. Criminals walked freely through the city for 2 nights. They robbed stores and threatened public safety. Frightened Americans all across the country waited to see what Governor Coolidge would do.
He took strong action. He called on state troops to end the strike. He said, "There is no right to strike against the public safety by anybody, anywhere, anytime." Most Americans approved of what Coolidge did. The people of Massachusetts supported him, too. they re-elected him governor by a large number of votes. Then, in 1920, Republicans nominated Warren Harding for president. They nominated Calvin Coolidge for vice president. When President Harding died in California, Coolidge, his wife, and two sons moved to the White House.
America's 30th president was, in some ways, an unusual kind of person to lead the country. He said little. He showed few feelings. Coolidge's policies as president were not active. He tried to start as few new programs as possible. He was a conservative Republican who believed deeply that government should be small. Coolidge expressed his belief this way: if the federal government should go out of existence, most people would not note the difference. And once, he said, 4/5 of our troubles in this life would disappear if we would only sit down and keep still.
Coolidge believed that private business, not the federal government, should lead the country to greater wealth and happiness. He continued President Harding's policy of supporting American business both inside the United States and in other countries. The government, under President Coolidge, continued high taxes on imports in an effort to help American companies.
Many Americans shared Coolidge's ideas about small government and big business. In the early 1920s, many of them were living better than ever before. At that time, companies were growing larger. The prices of their stocks rose higher and higher. There were lots of jobs, and the wages of many workers increased. Americans agreed with their president that there was little need for government spending and government programs when private industry seemed so strong.
The American economy grew in the 1920s for several reasons. The World War had destroyed many factories and businesses in Europe. The United States did not suffer the same destruction. It was still a young country. It had great natural resources, trained workers, and a huge market within its own borders. When peace came, Americans found their economy stronger than any other in the world.
Changes in the American market also helped economic growth. Installment buying became popular. In this system, people could buy a product and pay for it over a period of several weeks or months. The total cost was higher because they had to pay interest. But the system made it possible for more people to buy more goods. It also made the idea of borrowing money more acceptable to many Americans.
The growing importance of the New York stock markets also helped economic growth in the 1920s. Millions of Americans bought shares of stock in companies that seemed to grow bigger every month. Such investment almost became a national game. People would buy shares of stock, then sell them when the stock rose in value. There were many stories of poor people who became rich overnight by buying the right stocks. The American Congress also helped the economy by lowering income taxes. People had more money to spend on new goods. Another important reason for economic growth was a change in the way American companies were operated.
During the 1920s, the idea of manufacturing goods in the most scientific way became very popular. The father of this idea of scientific management was an engineer, Frederick Taylor. Mr. Taylor developed a system to study manufacturing. He studied each machine involved in the process. He studied how much work each person did. He studied how goods moved from one part of a factory to another. Then he offered ideas to business owners about ways to produce goods faster and for less cost.
Taylor's ideas of scientific management appealed to business owners. Automobile manufacturer Henry Ford proved that the ideas could work in his new car factory in the state of Michigan. Ford used the assembly line system of production. In this system, each worker did one thing to a product as it moved through the factory. This helped cut prices and increase wages.
Ford and other businessmen learned a great deal about how to control costs, set prices, and decide how much to produce. All these changes in production and marketing helped Ford and other American companies grow larger and stronger. Henry Ford's Model T car became popular throughout the country. So did other new products, radios, refrigerators for cooling food, vacuums to clean carpets, ready-made cigarettes, beauty products. Americans in the 1920s began to buy all kinds of new products they had never used before.
Calvin Coolidge was in the White House. However, business led the nation. Times were good. Americans trusted business and its leaders. It became an honor to call someone a businessman. Colleges organized business classes. Middle-class citizens in almost every city and town gathered to discuss business ideas. President Coolidge spoke for millions of Americans when he said, "The chief business of the American people is business."
Coolidge represented traditional values and a simple way of life. He knew exactly how every dollar he earned was saved or spent, and he spent no more money than was necessary. The strange thing was that Coolidge was extremely popular with a public that was spending large amounts of money. Some economic experts warned that the country's quick economic growth would end in economic depression. Most Americans, however, believed that the good times had come to stay. They enjoyed the good things in life that work and success in business could bring. On our next program, we will see how the economic growth of the 1920s brought exciting changes to the day-to-day life of millions of Americans.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.